Okay, so I think I was muted at the beginning, at the start of my introduction. So I apologize for that. People online just introduced myself. My name is Carrie Peterson. Use she, her pronouns. And the poem that I read was part of a poem called Befriending. It's Befriending Our Mortality by Andrea Gibson. I just read part of that. And I had some plans for tonight of what I wanted to share. And exploring this capacity that lies at the heart of all of the practices that we do, this capacity of mindfulness. And then I watched two different documentaries that happened to be about people who had already died and people who knew they were going to die somewhat soon and were speaking about their experience. So one was Andrea Gibson, poet I read from, and the other was Jane Goodall. I don't know if anyone's had a chance to, how many people have had a chance to see that. But speaking about their lives and their imminent, somewhat imminent death, as an invitation to reflect on one's own being, one's own life, one's own possibility, potential, capacity. And in watching both of those and listening to both of them, there was such a natural sense of spontaneous mindfulness that arose from hearing their reflections and contemplations, that I wanted to make sure that I include, just mention of how this capacity of mindfulness arises for us naturally in so many different situations. It isn't so much that we need to make it happen in a heavy-handed way. Like all qualities and capacities that we practice, that we cultivate, they are inherent within us, and we can develop them, and we can, practice accessing them more regularly. So, mindfulness is about being fully alive, not taking that life for granted. So, because this term has become so popular, so well researched, so studied and written about, it can start to seem like a term that means nothing and everything, both, right? So I'd like to kind of invite us at the beginning to kind of put the life back into mindfulness, right? This is not a kind of a dry scholarly pursuit. Even though Joseph Goldstein wrote a fantastic 400-page book about it that I use all the time as a reference, it's about how are we experiencing ourselves and our lives right here, right now? How are we relating to ourselves, to our minds, to each other, right here, right now? It is an alive quality. One that we experience directly and know for ourselves. So, before I talk about it, I want to invite, as I often do at the beginning of talks, that the talk not be something that sort of gets your intellectual or perhaps academic brain going, but maybe something that you can experience directly as I'm speaking. Yeah. So that's like the best possible outcome for a talk is that you actually stay rooted in your own experience and know what's happening moment to moment, inside, outside. So that's the invitation. You can keep some mindful awareness in your body as you're listening. You'll still understand what's being said. It's still possible. It's excellent practice. So just like to kind of start with that invitation as we dive in tonight. So mindfulness is the next to last fold on the eightfold path. Contrary to how many of us start, it's not the first in this particular list, but it comes after factors that encourage wisdom, lead towards wisdom, factors that encourage a kind of ethical sensitivity, how we are in the world, what we do with our actions. And this last kind of category of factors has to do with how we cultivate our own minds and hearts. So in the Pali, the word, most of you, many of you probably know, that mind and heart are together, right? That word is citta. So the mind, heart are together. So when we say mindfulness, we're not talking about our thinking mind, but we're actually talking more globally about a mind that knows experience as it's happening and also is affected by experience as it's happening. So it's a little bit wider, has more depth and breadth than it might initially appear. But again, the definition of mindfulness is not the thing itself. So the classical definition, if we translate it, so it's closest to the original, sati in Pali, basically just means to remember or to bear something in mind. It's actually a very simple definition, to bear something in mind. And as mindfulness has gone and expanded, and more of us have explored it in more depth, there are all of these other aspects and nuances and subtleties that go along with it. But the history of the word, and I won't go too far into this, many of you might know this, but in the late 1800s, the translators who were translating the texts from Pali into English were looking for a word that could encapsulate the original meaning of mindfulness that had a lot to do with this capacity to remember, but also had was referring to this ability to be awake and alert in this present moment. So they were trying to find something that could span both this memory aspect and this present moment aspect. And they were trying to find a term that could be relatable to an audience that had been somewhat steeped in the Anglican church. So mindful was a term that people could relate to. I have some frame of reference for. Of course, later, Jon Kabat-Zinn kind of popularized the term mindfulness when he developed mindfulness-based stress reduction. There's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and all of these applications, again, looking for a term that could be relatable, that would somehow point to the depth of the Dharma. I remember reading this some time ago, that mindfulness is, they call it a revived noun, right? So a noun that's been revived over time, like maybe it's fallen out of popularity and then it goes through periods of resurgence where it gets revived. So it's been revived twice. But really, as we look more deeply into the texts out of which this mindfulness emerges, it's less a noun and more of a verb. It is more of an action and a process. So some definitions that teachers that I have appreciated have put forward, and just different ways of getting at this. So Steve Armstrong for many years used remembering to recognize the present moment's experience. So again, bringing that aspect of memory, remembering to recognize the present moment's experience. Andy Alensky, the scholar, uses a very simple term, simple, unadorned awareness. So there's an aspect of mindfulness that allows us to be aware of things in their fullness, just as they are, without elaboration, without conceptualization, without proliferation, just aware of things in a simple, unadorned way. Right. So there's this bare attention aspect, but there's also this aspect of remembering kind of the context of the teachings. So remembering the possibility of being able to practice with what we're experiencing in the present moment. So I know sometimes the definitions get a little tricky and confusing, but people have been arguing about what mindfulness really is for a couple hundred years. And I think one of the most helpful ways of approaching it is to look at some of the images or the similes that the Buddha used. Because even though the words might change over time, he would often point to or give examples from everyday life as people were experiencing it, so they could get a felt sense of what he was referring to with different qualities. So I'd like to just offer a few of the similes, just as a way of kind of expanding, broadening the definition, but also bringing it into more of a lived reality or lived relationship. Bringing us close to an active capacity that is more like a process. Right? So I was reading something a while ago about, I think it was mindfulness-based cognitive therapy or some application of mindfulness, and they referred to it as a reality-based approach. It's a reality-based approach, and I loved that. And I think of mindfulness in general. We can talk about whether, like, an approach for what, but it is reality-based. It is encouraging a relationship with reality that is harmonious, that is true, that lessens a relationship that is based on in the early text that says greed and distress for the world. So we're aware of the present moment's experience, but we're aware of it in a certain kind of way. And the teachings point to this capacity to practice with things, to be mindful of things, so that our greed and distress for the world is lessening. Anyone notice any greed or distress for the world lately? Yes. So this is a wonderfully practical, powerful tool in these times, right? It doesn't mean that greed and distress will not arise, but it points to a capacity to relate to them differently. Okay, so for some of the images, and again, as you're listening, you can just kind of feel into how do I experience this? And there are so many different possible objects of mindfulness that the Buddha recommended, right? This is not a one size fits all, or there's one right way to be mindful for everyone at all times. These are huge, hugely varied body of teachings. And the Buddha was often pointing towards a sense of balance in someone's mind. Yeah. So for the mind that was scattered or restless, he would offer a certain teaching or a place to place one's attention. For the mind that was sinking or dull or heavy, there was another arena of mindfulness to explore. So it was always very specific, and we too can feel our way into what is helpful when. That's a capacity of discernment that we can start to notice. But remembering that we're leading towards this relationship in which greed and distress are lessening, or moving towards a sense of freedom. Okay. So one more aspect of the definition before I go into the images, and this is more recent for me. Because this is not, in some ways it's straightforward, but in some ways it's very nuanced. So Joseph Goldstein in his book on mindfulness says, trying to define mindfulness is a bit like trying to define art. Right? Like our experience of it will change over time, and it should change over time. Ajahn Suchito says, with mindfulness, this is our capacity to lift off just slightly of the present moment's experience, just enough to gain perspective on it. So to lift off or to step back just enough to gain perspective on it. So we can do that as we turn towards the body, the breathing, our feelings, our mind states, everything that arises in our experience, we can turn towards it in this way, lift off in this way. So one of the images that comes forward for me, again, in trying to explain things in a more descriptive way, sometimes we miss the mark entirely. So I was, and nowhere is this more apparent to me than in parenting, right? When you're trying to describe something that might be helpful for especially a preteen. So I was trying to explain to my son, who's 12, he clearly had something bothering him, and it was kind of nagging him in the background. And I could see it. It was agitating him. And when something's agitating, you can see it physically in his body. There's a heaviness and an unsettledness. And I was trying to explain to him that just had suggestions about what he should do with that. And he's like, no, I just want to, let's just keep going, Mom, keep going. Let's just do something. Let's just do something. Keep going. I want to get past this. Which is often what we do when things are uncomfortable, right? Why would I want to be with this? I want to just get past it. So my suggestion, because our current obsession, we have to have one obsession every winter, and our current obsession is ping pong. That's the activity of choice to get us through this winter. And I said, okay, well, just bring whatever is behind you onto the ping pong table. So bring it out from behind, out in front, and then we'll play with it. We'll play with it. Yeah. And so we started doing that. So we brought the heavy, kind of whatever oppressive feeling out from behind, out in front, so we could relate to it differently, so we could start to play with it. And sure enough, without my going head on directly at it, what came forward was feeling as though I'm not, don't want to be too revealing here, but feeling like I'm not quite good enough at math, right? Just a simple human experience, not quite good enough at this. And so when it was in the background, there wasn't anything we could do. It was driving from behind. But when we put whatever is kind of in the background, out in the front, we shine the light of mindfulness on it, it changes our sense of possibility and choice. We have all of these different ways that we can relate to it. And it wasn't so neat and tidy, but it unfolded over a few days that we could explore that thought, that belief a little bit differently in the emotions that went around with it. And there was a sense of lightness. It wasn't completely gone, but there was a way of holding and relating to it differently. So we can bring all of our creativity to this. We can bring all of our kind of skillful means to this. Okay, so the images. And I love these because I can sort of feel them and sense them immediately. And the first one that I want to mention that I often use is the Buddha describes mindfulness, especially mindfulness when it's established in the body, as like somebody who is walking through a crowd. And he, in the sutta, he actually invited people to imagine this. So imagine you're walking with a crowd of people on one side, some kind of pageant or celebration on the other side. You're walking in between. You have a bowl of oil on your head that you're balancing. You have a swordsman behind you. And you are walking through this crowd, and the crowd is watching the, I think it's like a beauty pageant or some kind of celebration. And your job is to stay balanced and aware, because if you spill a drop of oil, the swordsman behind you will kill you. So the ability that we would have in that moment to stay alert, to stay mindful, to stay rooted in the body would be quite something, right? So there's this capacity to be deeply centered and rooted in our own experience when we can sense the importance of it, right? So it's not to become stiff and rigid and tight, but this also points to our capacity to remain undistracted when we can really see the benefit and the potential. So in this time, when everything is pulling for our attention, clamoring for our attention, and the most intelligent engineering minds have recognized that our attention is a valuable resource, that when we pay attention and things that can keep our attention make other people money, lots of money, right? So to reclaim our attention, our ability to hold it and keep it and sustain it is in some ways a revolutionary act, but restores a vital capacity that we have to stay centered and rooted in the present moment on behalf of our own deepest well-being, so that we can have a choice of where we move it and direct it. It's not just continually going out, going out, going out, being dispersed, oil spilling everywhere, right? If you're anything like me. So to really feel the potential for that kind of rootedness. Not that it's bad when we're not, but that mindfulness that's really rooted in our own direct knowing, our own direct experience. Another image that the Buddha uses for this capacity of mindfulness is of six animals, wild animals that are all used to being in their own kind of territory. Can't remember what the six are. But imagine that they were tied together with like one rope. And so one wants to go one way back to its home. The other wants to go the other way back to its home. The other two want to go the other way. And they're all pulling and tugging and trying to get us to go this way and that. So this is what happens when everything that makes contact with our senses, every sight, sound, touch, mental impression is leading to something that draws our awareness away, out and away. Yeah. So the experience of it is feeling this pull, being pulled this way, that being pulled, and not being able to settle. So mindfulness is compared in this simile to a post that's rooted into the ground, and the animals that are pulling this way and that, when they're rooted to the post, they will pull for a while. And we can just for a moment put aside the ethical conundrum of animals attached to a rope and a post. But for the sake of the simile, if they're attached to the post, which is mindfulness deeply rooted in the present moment, especially in the body, eventually they will tire and they will settle down and they will kind of surrender to the experience of being in the present moment. So there are lots of ways to talk about this and describe this, but one of the things that we see as we're mindful of our own experience moment to moment, again and again, is not so much that it's bad to be carried away, but that it's exhausting to be carried away. It's exhausting. And it feels better to stay rooted and connected, as Philip Moffat says, as best we're able, as best we're able, that it actually starts to feel better to be present. So this is this gets at some of the different capacities of mindfulness, potentials and functions. Another simile that's used is one of a gatekeeper, right? So this gets a little bit more at the discernment faculty of mindfulness. So when we're aware of our present moment's experience, what's happening in the body, what arises in the mind, in the emotions and thoughts, we can be very discerning, start to become very discerning about what is helpful and what is not helpful. So this gatekeeper is, again, someone who has a wider view and has this idea in mind of what is helpful and what is not. So letting people in or through who will be helpful, and not rejecting or hating those that won't, but leaving them aside for now, right? So we don't do this, it's not that we're rejecting actual people, it's a simile, but it's meant to get at what arises in the mind and what we kind of pursue and what we let go, what we don't pick up. Right? So there are impulses and energies and surges that can move through the heart mind that are not helpful to pick up and follow. So that gatekeeper is not acting out of aversion, but in discernment as to what is helpful to keep in mind right now. And what is not? What is helpful as a frame of reference right now, and what is not? So this kind of gatekeeper, and this is said to be a very protective quality. So I think this is helpful also if we can get in touch with the protective aspect of mindfulness. It protects our mind. Kind of keeps our mind safe from the domination of the hindrances, many of the hindrances. Okay. All right. So this is what one teacher called the mind at normalcy. Right. So when we're not being pulled out again and again, when we are able to kind of center and arrive and stabilize, find steadiness in the present moment, we get to experience the mind at some kind of normalcy. So this is what Upasaka Ki, the wonderful meditation, she's a meditation master, but also a Thai laywoman, called the mind at normalcy. And this is when we start to move from being aware not so much of the contents of awareness, not so much of, not so embedded in what arises in awareness, but more with the knowing itself. Yeah. So she talked about this as experiencing the mind at normalcy. She said, if you can take your stance right at awareness, so aware of this knowing quality, If you're skilled at this kind of looking, the mind will learn how to be at peace. You'll start to know how things arise and disband. But first, practice keeping awareness right within yourself so that your mindfulness can be firm, so that it won't need to label things as good or bad, as what I like or don't like, but just keep checking to see that when the mind can be at normalcy, centered and neutral as its primary stance, then whatever it knows or sees, it will be able to contemplate and let go. Then whatever it knows and sees, it will be able to contemplate and let go. An inward staying, unentangled knowing. All outward going knowing cast aside. An inward staying, unentangled knowing. All outward going knowing cast aside. So this is the experience of being rooted in the present moment. It does not mean that we aren't aware of what is going on around us. It means we're not entangled in it in the same way. So in the Sutta on the Establishments of Mindfulness, again and again, the Buddha said we can be aware internally, we can be aware externally, we can be aware inside, we can be aware outside, but we're not entangled with what's known outside or inside. So, one last image. And I like this one because this one can emphasize a little bit more of the relaxed quality of practice. And this is one of a cowherd. So the Buddha was often mentioning things that farmers would relate to well, could understand. And so he was saying that just like cowherds who are tending cows. During the season when the crops are ripening, the cowherd has to watch over the cows very closely to make sure that they don't eat the harvest. So there's a kind of vigilance that's involved. So there's a kind of checking. You know, if there are a lot of hindrances moving through us, there might be a lot of checking. A lot of that more vigilant kind of knowing. And over time, we have to be very kind of discerning at this stage, you know, knowing what's helpful to let in, knowing what's helpful to keep out. But over time, there's a different season that comes. So this is the season when the harvest has already been cultivated, and there is a bit of continuity of mindfulness, and the cowherd, person attending to the cows, can kind of rest back and relax a little bit more out in the open, aware of the whole field, and just aware that the cows are there. It doesn't have to be so kind of up close and vigilant in the same way. Vigilant probably isn't a great word to use for mindfulness because there's a lot of tension involved in it, but a kind of watchfulness, a carefulness. So this other aspect of mindfulness is when we can rest back and just know, okay, those potential states are there. The cows are there. Right now they're not causing havoc. I can just kind of keep an open awareness of the whole field and just know that those elements are there. Those energies are there. I want to just end with one quote. Yeah, there's always so much more to say, but I want to just leave this one quote from Ajahn Suchito. And this gets at some of the aspects of mindfulness that I've been pointing to. And this is this description of mindfulness. I won't have time to go into it fully, but arose for him very naturally out of watching whirling dervishes. So here's another image, but from the Sufi tradition, maybe you can picture it. There are dervishes that tune into a certain sound or note, and they're not aware. They do this in a group, and they turn in individual circles, but their eyes aren't open. They're just aware in this kind of 360-degree awareness, centered in their own kind of bodily form, but aware outside. So they're turning around their own sense of centered stillness, but also aware of the group around them in this trained, wonderfully beautiful, choreographed dance. And so Ajahn Suchito describes this in a talk as this is the experience of embodiment, of embodied awareness and mindfulness. So this sense of not clinging, the sense of non-clinging and yet focused, external and yet not caught up in the external, internal and yet not holding on to oneself in the internal, not clinging internally, not clinging externally, but in balance. What becomes possible when that kind of balance is present? Things will come into harmony. They do come into harmony rather than control. This is exquisite. This is our potential. So sama, this quality that is part of every aspect of the Eightfold Path, sama sati, right or wise or attuned mindfulness, is this capacity to come into harmony with our experience, internally, externally, to know it fully, know it completely. And this can give rise to a sense of awe. And so just as we close, kind of end just as I began. So these are the last lines of Andrea Gibson's poem that I began with. So in this they write, awe is the most powerful medicine in the world. I have never felt awe and shame at the same time, awe and loneliness at the same time, awe and judgment at the same time, and nothing wakes us to awe more than life's brevity, which is to say, forming an intimate relationship with our mortality could not only save us, it could save our world. If you don't believe me, tell me the last time you saw anything bite with its jaw dropped. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. So mindfulness is a capacity that is right here, closer than the breath, inherent part of our aliveness right now. Very ordinary in some ways. But possibly changing our experience, our perspective, in ways that are quite extraordinary. Freeing, opening. Okay, thank you everybody for your attention tonight. Thank you. Hope some of this was useful. Hopefully expanding, broadening our sense of mindfulness. I'd love to hear a little bit from people, whoever might be willing. So, your own reflections, comments, questions. Yeah, please. So.
Thank you for your words, Carrie, and for all of the etymology of the word mindfulness and its usage in recent past. I feel like for me, mindfulness has taken on a new quality of bodyfulness and heartfulness. In the West, I think I get stuck with mind as something intellectual and conceptual. And so it's been helpful for me to think of heart-mind or body-heart, and sort of have the experience of the present moment more resonate in my heart body rather than in my mind, which I sort of associate with my head space.
Yes.
And also in being present to the present moment, inviting in the unpleasantness and inviting in the hard feelings.
That's right.
And letting those touch the heart space as well helps me be more present.
That's right. Yeah, great.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. And I think it is meant to encompass our whole experience. I mean, the four foundations of mindfulness are meant to, we're meant to kind of systematically include everything. You know, body, feelings, feelings of pleasant or unpleasant, our emotions, our mental states, our thoughts. So that sutta, which all mindfulness practices are based on, has us go through things really systematically so we can really get a sense of them one at a time. But they're all happening all at once, as the saying goes. So sometimes it is helpful to focus on particular aspects at a particular time, just like you experienced, like, oh, I actually need to remember that the body is part of it. Body is primary. So whether it's there for you right in the definition or you add it, just to know that that is part of the whole kind of living experience that the Buddha was pointing to, is really, really helpful. So thanks for bringing that up. Definitely not alone. And you'll hear different teachers talk about heartfulness or talk about loving awareness as a way to kind of bring in kindness with it. I think it's helpful to just know what is useful in terms of that, including everything and bringing the mind to balance and center. So lots of skillful means for that. Great.
Thank you for speaking today. I have two questions. The first one is, when you talk about mindfulness, I think a lot about flow. That's a definition that when I think about being really present, whether I'm playing a sport or presenting and I have to be very focused, when I think about flow, it's definitely not a state I can sustain throughout my entire day because I'm very much in my element, but concentrated for 30 minutes probably. I guess I'm curious about the balance of being present in terms of flow makes sense to me, but a lower effort of being present that's not flow. Do you have any words around how to be mindful without that level of concentration?
Yeah. So in these last three folds of the eightfold path, the three factors or folds are effort, mindfulness, and concentration, and they're all interweaving all the time. So the idea behind effort is to experiment with adjusting our effort so that we can sustain a continuity of mindfulness. And that continuity of mindfulness, which can in some instances feel like flow, maybe not that heightened, but when it's sustained, that kind of effortless, sustained mindfulness, which we'll talk more about when we get to concentration, but can feel like a kind of flow. And so your object isn't the game or the sport or the, you know, musical performance, but it's the present moment and all of its facets. So how that grows is by getting to know our minds really, really well in lots of different circumstances. When we're still, when we're engaged with others, when we're walking, when we're sitting, when we're lying down, so we get to know ourselves and what are helpful supports for maintaining mindfulness when we're engaged in everyday activities. And so it's less about me maintaining a mindful state, right? And more about a kind of open exploration for what's helpful. Yeah, so there are times where mindfulness directed to the body is extremely helpful. There's a time when a more open awareness, when we're getting tight, pulled in, contracted, clenched, be the cowherd in the post-harvest season, you know, where you're resting back, just knowing that things are there, not up close and personal with them. So it's a continual experiment with effort and that ability to kind of sustain over time. But once mindfulness is continuous, it has a lot of similarities. I think we can talk about this more next month, but concentration and flow, I think, can have a lot of similarities.
So. That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah.
My second question is, the topic of mortality does help with bringing in the brevity of the present. I do think giving space to that thought does help a lot with the appreciation of the present and the reality of it.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a good practice to often introduce and remind ourselves about mortality? Okay. Yeah,
I do. Yeah, there are lots of skillful ways, and almost all wisdom traditions suggest it in some form.
Okay.
So there are many different ways that you can do that. There's a teaching called the Five Recollections, but you can notice the benefit, like you just mentioned, of what happens when you bear that in mind, that there is more of an appreciation of the present and more of an interest in being present. So the Buddha in the discourse on establishing mindfulness called some of this ardency. Like there's an ardency to our mindfulness, or there becomes a kind of warmth and a certain kind of intensity. You know, when we realize, yes, this is the reality of things. So it can be a really helpful support for bringing a full mindful presence to whatever is arising. So yes, you don't want to overdo it, especially if you're kind of prone in a certain direction towards despair and decay anyway. It's not usually a helpful contemplation. So again, know your own mind and what's helpful. Thank you. And then I think Sherry had a comment.
The cowherd, is it developmental to go from the watchfulness to the wide view, or is that a kind of cycle we're always involved in?
That's a great question. Yeah. There is an aspect of mindfulness that we can't avoid, and that is getting to know the hindrances. And so in that way, nobody gets around that. Nobody gets to be the restful cowherd without some wrestling with the hindrances and getting to know them. So in that way, there is some developmental capacity in that we gain some facility, we gain some ability to know what's happening and what a helpful approach is. So yes, in some way that it's a maturing, but when we're being restful, we often still get overtaken sometimes and have to kind of go back to a more careful watching, more careful, kind attention. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Great question. Those online, I don't want to neglect. Yes. Is it Tamira?
Yeah, hi, Carrie.
Hi.
My thought's not fully formed, but it has to do with the seeing what's here, like really turning towards it, and also this theme that we've been talking about with death. So this last week, we've had a lot of ICE agents in our small town, especially last Monday, and I'm on rapid response team. So I was doing a lot of chasing them around, just attempting to draw attention to their presence, get the word out with the local community so people could stay safe. And, you know, last Monday we had 20 of them in our town. And at the end of the day, I was reflecting on my behavior and my engagement and just like, thinking about, I wish I had done better or stayed more open-hearted or stayed more grounded. And I was just like reflecting on like, okay, what's really here? Like what is getting me ungrounded? What's getting me to have hate in my heart? Mm-hmm. And you know, some of it was definitely fear, like these, you know, I had an encounter where I ended up getting hit and thinking I was going to end up getting kidnapped. Mm. You know, and part of this was like, you know, I started thinking about death in relationship to this and like recognizing my own mortality. And it just brought me a lot of peace in knowing that I'm going to continue to engage with these guys and do what I can for my town. And not that I have like any sort of death wish. You know, that's not what I want, but it was just like seeing really clearly, like, you know, I could get hit in a crosswalk tomorrow and be dead. Right. And like also, you know, I can do this thing for my community and like maybe that it's entirely possible that it could end up causing all sorts of impacts in my life up to and including death. And just like really facing that, has allowed me to be a lot more grounded these next 5 or 6 days after that day. And, I don't know. I'm still reflecting on it and still trying to figure out like, how can I keep my heart open in the face of this? And like, how can I come from a place of care and kindness and trying to understand in the face of really horrible things that are being done? But it was just, I don't know, somehow that contemplation of death was very helpful.
Thank you, Tamira. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know that I have a question in that.
Yeah,
it's just been reflecting on it, but open to any thoughts.
I appreciate the reflection. Yeah, and what comes to mind too, I trust your practice, and that it's, you can bear in mind what's skillful, and that balance of wisdom and compassion, you know, in which wisdom brings the clarity and the ability to really sense and remember what's true and learn from what's true. And there's the just the very human kind of softening and compassion of the heart that is there, because it is difficult and it is hard, and there are things that we can do and there are things that we don't have control of. And so the human aspect of kindness, care, and compassion comes forward too when I'm hearing you and listening to you. So,
yes, my hope is that it can come forward out of my heart the next time, rather than a bunch of screaming expletives, right?
Yeah. And just to honor that intention, right? It doesn't mean we're going to get it right every time. It doesn't mean that we're going to, you know, go forward as perfect beacons of love all the time. But that intention has so much energy and potential. And so we can have the ability to forgive ourselves over and over and over again when we are... when other aspects or energies come forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also for me, that courage to turn towards
the
reflection itself and say, yeah, this, like, of course, this is human. And like, sure, shame, guilt, desire to do better. Like, these are all human, and it's, and like, let's see what's here.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And I hope people sense too that this is one of the best functions of Sangha. And I know certainly in my own practice, just naming some of these things out loud in community is tremendously helpful. And doesn't mean that they need an answer or solution or they need to be fixed, but simply to have them kind of known in community is very, very helpful. So thank you for bringing that forward and allowing us to be with you in that. So let's just take one quick moment, just as we're closing. No need to do anything fancy with your posture. But just a simple inclining of our minds, or holding the intention that the benefit of our practice be shared. Whatever benefit may have come from tonight, maybe a simple sense of warmth or interest, connectedness, ease, understanding. We might not be able to name it, likely not, but we can form the intention that that benefit be shared, that it radiate out in all directions. May our practice be of benefit for ourselves and all beings everywhere, without exception. May all beings be well. May all beings be free of confusion and fear. May all beings take care of themselves and each other with ease. And may we continue to move in the direction of greater wisdom, compassion, and freedom in our own unique ways.